Hey folks, Scott Weingart here, and this is an MCRIT podcast. In fact, specifically, it is an MCRIT Critical Care Bounce Backs podcast with my buddy Mike Weinstock, who is the author of the Bounce Back series of books, which if you're not reading them, you are crazy. And I was the consulting editor, much akin to Sherlock Holmes for the Critical Care Bounce Backs edition, so I'm particularly fond of anything that comes from this book. So Mike comes on perennially to discuss a chapter, and he's always kind enough to give you that chapter for free. You could find it in the show notes. And if you like it, then buy the book. Now, what you should not buy is Mike's former book on medical legal bounce backs. And the reason why is a second edition is coming out soon, and we'll have Mike back on the podcast when that's actually available. So if you love the Critical Care Bounce Backs book, do not buy that second book because a new edition is coming and you'll feel very forlorn. So before we jump in real quick, a new course that I'm offering with my coaching partner, Rob Orman, which is called the Out on Time course. And the idea is so many of our clients are miserable because they're staying like 2 hours after their shift finishing charts, or they just don't know how to get the hell out of there. So we're going to have a course specifically on that. We'll teach you how to document rapidly and yet in a way that is protective from medical legal woes, and in a way that will bill maximally. So super rapid and yet bills and protects you, and therefore you could get out on time. We're going to teach you to document in real time so you not have a stack of charts, chart debt, that makes our clients miserable. So this is going to be the only iteration of this course that is live. It'll be a 6-session course in preparation for what it will eventually be, which is an asynchronous course with video recording. So if you like a live course, this is the only time you're going to be able to get it. So if you're interested in that, if you want to get out on time, if you want to be not miserable at the end of your shift with like 20 charts that still need to be done, then just go to Out on Time course, all one word, Out OnTimeCourse.com, OutOnTimeCourse.com, and check it out. All right, let's get into the show. Mike Weinstock with a case of, quote, asymptomatic hypertension. That's not at all ominous, right? And so this is a long one, so, buckle in. This is for a long car ride or to be listened to in installments, but it's so good, I think, and I think you will find it to be so as well. Let's jump right in. Hey, Mike, it is so good to have you back on the show again. You are a regular visitor to MCRIT because the stuff you do is so friggin' good. And you are best known for what we're going to speak about today, which is bounce back cases. Mike, what do you have for us?
This is a quintessential bounce back case. And I'm going to start off, Scott, and thank you so much. And it's always an honor to be here, of course. This is a patient, a 55-year-old man who has a history of hypertension. And I'm just going to really briefly summarize his initial visit. And he got sent home. I'm going to only ask you one question about the initial visit because things get really interesting when he bounces back. And for this Bounce Back Critical Care book, we focus on that return visit. So this is a 53-year-old man who has no documented past medical history. He presented to the emergency department and his blood pressure was 202 over 15. This was because he had checked it at a pharmacy and he'd found a high blood pressure there. So he figured he better rush himself immediately to the emergency department.
Mike, could I just say, I fucking hate those machines. Those machines need to be eliminated from the world. But okay, I'm sorry. Well, I interrupt your flow. You keep going.
Since you were saying that, I will tell a little bit of a self-deprecating story on that. My wife, who's a primary care doctor, I told her, man, I got home from a shift where I had some of these asymptomatic elevated blood pressure patients. And I said, Beth, if it was up to me, these things would be banned. And she said, Mike, you're an idiot. So there you go. I think primary care obviously loves them.
We're self-serving in our desire for these machines not to be there. I'm sure in the space of the world, they're actually helping people, but not our lives.
Not our lives, yes. So summarizing that initial visit, patient had a normal exam. And I will say the neuro exam was cranial nerves 2 to 12, grossly intact. So we can talk about that in a second if we want to. Medical decision making, patient presents with asymptomatic hypertension, no evidence of hypertensive emergency, such as chest pain, shortness of breath, and neurologic deficit. Per ASEP guidelines, no indication for further testing. We'll refer to primary care doctor to follow up in the next 2 or 3 days. So Scott, I told you I was only going to ask you one question about this initial visit before we get to the more interesting stuff. And simply, my question to you is, would you have done anything differently on this initial visit?
Yeah, I would have, but I think what they did is fine. There's nothing wrong with it. So I think it's really just my practice philosophy rather than my doing something different indicates they did something wrong. I don't think they did. But for me, I always like sending the labs. I don't even necessarily keep the patient around to check them. It just is now moving the visit forward when they do arrive to their primary medical doctor, because otherwise they're going to have to send off labs at that visit and then wait for them to get back before this poor patient gets treatment. And so it doesn't hurt anything. It behooves me to check them even though the patient's gone, but I would send a chemistry at least. And I like to start antihypertensive meds, not because I think it's going to protect me from liability, not because I think it's necessary, but because when they get to their primary care doctor, it means they could say, I have been on a thiazide for 2 weeks, and then they could go forward and decide where they want to go from there. So I'm just helping these patients to move along their care. But again, I would no way say that either of those things is necessary.
So I have a list just to add on to what you talked about. The first is such a simple thing is to recheck the blood pressure, because I've so frequently found that blood pressure and the recheck is maybe not 120 over 80, but the recheck is totally acceptable relative to the initial blood pressure, whether that's from the cough or the patient being anxious because they're in the emergency department. Second is, and this is a little bit of a pet peeve of mine, if you're going to do a neuro exam, just do a neuro exam. These days, it's not as important to get one more element in your physical as far as billing stuff. But this was clearly one of those across-the-room neuro exams. And if you really want to do it, it doesn't take long, but check cranial nerves and check strength and maybe even have the patient walk. So the third point is, and I like to document my discussion with them, this is why it's important to have your blood pressure treated, maybe not for the next 5 minutes, but for the next number of years. And this is one of the really big things that we can do. It's great to take care of car accident victims or STEMIs, but really smoking cessation and blood pressure management, we'd probably save more lives, not to diminish our profession at all. And then finally, as far as the follow-up and the medications, just put in there that documentation of the patient's understanding of the importance for follow-up. So Scott, all of that, and then the ASAP guidelines, if you're going to be quoting ASAP guidelines or say the patient is PERC negative or whatever, please just make sure that those guidelines or that clinical decision tool actually what you are saying, because as it turns out, the ASAP guidelines weren't quite as definitive for this as this clinician put in there.
Yeah, what specifically did they miss, Mike?
Yeah, so ASAP guidelines does say that you don't need to start medications initially, but pretty important to realize that though they say that, first of all, they're 10-year-old or now 11-year-old guidelines, but in addition to that, this is a level C recommendation, and I'm just always cautious. In fact, a lot of times when I do lectures, I say, who feels comfortable in front of their peers, just for example, with the PERC rule, standing up and saying all of the elements of that? And no one ever stands up for that, probably because they're in front of all their peers, right? But if you feel like you know those guidelines backwards and forwards and they really support your treatment decision, go for it. But I'm guessing that most of us aren't as familiar, and with the most recent, it's really probably better just to say that we've recognized the blood pressure is elevated, we're concerned about that, and we're either going to start medicines or not, but then ensure that the patient understands the importance of follow-up.
Now, this is just a future Weingart jumping in here because I want to make sure no one is confused. The ASAP guidelines do give you the space to not send labs, not do screening, and to not start medications. Mike's point, and it is such a good one, is first of all, you have to be crazy unless you know every word of those guidelines to ever introduce them in your note, because what you're essentially saying is this is now a definitive vision of how things should be if this chart was ever to be reviewed in a medical legal fashion, when there's actually no gain to that, because there might be things in those guidelines that you do not want in your medical legal analysis of a case, even though the one thing you're quoting actually is beneficial to you, there might be other stuff there, and it's not worth it. A much better line would simply be, I considered the need for screening or initiation of medications for this patient's asymptomatic hypertension, but decided since patient is likely to follow up and had the potential to do so, that the screening or initiation in the ED was unnecessary, or something to that effect. All you have to show is that you understood that some people might look at this and say you should have sent labs and started medication, and you understood that. but you decided not to. And then you're totally safe, because what you don't want your chart to show is that you never even considered that it's a possibility to send labs or start medications, because then it's like, what the hell were you doing? But no, you want to say, I had a careful consideration of it. And any wording you could do that makes that known, simply stating, you understand some people might send labs, some people might start meds, but you opted not to for whatever reason, is much better than saying ACEP guidelines. You don't want that in there. All right, let's get back to the show. 100%. And in addition to prescribing a starter medication, I put the fear of death into them. And then that goes into my chart. Because if we're going to blow these off, and I think we probably should, this is not the place for working up asymptomatic hypertension in the emergency department, we need to make sure they do get to a person who could do that. And you need to put in the chart that you told the patient that there is a risk if this continues for some middle period of time that they could have pretty bad sequelae. And I put in things like you could have a heart attack, you could have a stroke. This needs to be managed. It doesn't need to be managed today. Let me push you on the neuro exam a little bit, Mike. If we did not know this was a bounce back, obviously does the story the patient came in with somewhat denote that this patient was indeed okay? If this patient, but for finding out the number of their blood pressure at the drugstore, was walking around happily in their life, I can't think of too many neuro things that would present with such a subtle but discoverable neuro finding that it would change the course of this patient. So is this another example of res ipsa loquitur, where the patient's very story precludes the necessity of a detailed neuro exam?
I'm really happy to be called out on that, because explaining what I mean is so important. That I personally, and this is a revelation, but I don't do a neuro exam on patients with asymptomatic elevated blood pressure. I just don't do that at all. And I guess what I'm thinking here is just that next level of just using a macro that has something in there, like head atraumatic, for example, or cranial nerves 2 to 12 normal. It doesn't kill you if you end up going to medical legal action, but it just makes you seem a little bit sloppy. Yeah, did you check the visual acuity when you checked cranial nerves too? Probably not. Or does the patient have a glass eye? Or is there some other thing that tells us that you were just using a macro? And again, this isn't going to sink a medical legal case. Why even put it on there if you didn't do it? It doesn't help you at all. And even if there's a chance that it could hurt you, I just don't see the advantage of having it there.
I love it. Okay, now that you've clarified, it makes complete sense. So if you were going to have a macro for patients like this, would it be helpful to have a macro saying patient speaking with normal speech, gait, walking into the emergency department or walking out, looks good, no further neuro exam indicated at this time? Would that be helpful or hurtful?
It would be very helpful. And one thing we find so frequently with medical legal cases is that the more specific documentation trumps everything else. So alert and oriented times three is fine with an ankle sprain patient. But if you have a patient with actual neuro symptoms, well, saying something like alert and oriented times three, comma, the patient easily and readily knows the day, month, and year, or something like that, the more specific documentation for the focus of that patient's visit is invaluable if there's an adverse outcome to actually understand what transpired when you saw that patient at the bedside.
I love it. All right. Is there anything else we need to discuss before we get the unfortunate return of this patient?
Just speaking to that sort of same theme as when you asked about the neuro exam, I want everyone to understand that though there was a bad outcome here, this does not mean we need to change our management of patients with asymptomatic elevated blood pressure, except for, again, trying to improve it as much and the things that we talked about just recently here. But the fact that there was a bad outcome, we shouldn't change our practice based on that. And of course, we know that there's going to be, and this is where the discussions get even more interesting here. But the fact is, we send these patients home all the time, but we send them home for some defined follow-up, which is exactly what happened at this time too. So we're not saying something wrong was done, but maybe we could have moved from standard of care to excellence in care. Would that have changed the outcome in this situation? Almost for sure it would not have.
All right. Fantastic. What's next?
No big surprise here. The patient did bounce back. So the patient was sent home just before 10 o'clock p.m. And the next day, the patient returns. This is about 24 hours later. So this is documented at 11:02 p.m. the next day. Patient is a 53-year-old male, brought in by ambulance with seizures, but no known history of seizure disorder. And at this time, his blood pressure is 224 over 140. His heart rate's 126. They document acutely ill, afebrile. His pupils are sluggish, and the patient is actively seizing at this time. So, Scott, what I thought I'd do is very rapid fire, bring a bunch of questions to you, because in the same way as the book, we want to put the listener at the bedside in the footsteps of the emergency physician, and then you are going to be our expert whisperer.
Sounds good.
Okay. So just painting the picture, I think we all get what's happening here. We got a patient with elevated blood pressure who's actively seizing. So maybe this isn't super complex as far as the first question, but Scott, what do you think is a differential diagnosis that we need to be considering with this likely diagnosis? And then what are a little bit less common things, but things that you should be thinking about also?
Yeah, for me, first is just treating the seizures, I think, before I even have a differential, because I can't examine anything else at this stage of the game, because the patient's blood pressure is going to be affected by seizing. Generally, you're not getting fantastic readings off the cuff, and if they are, they're high. So I think I terminate and then decide what to do next. And so once I knew the patient wasn't hypoglycemic, my first move would be to give benzodiazepines. Now, most people are familiar with giving lorazepam. My practice has changed. I find that zonks them, and it's at least, I could say midazolam is at least as good. So I've pretty much moved for these termination of seizure moves to midazolam. And on this patient who is actively seizing with EMS, I would probably just give a reasonably big dose. So I'd give 4 milligrams of midazolam to this patient. And Mike, you did say he had gotten some lorazepam with EMS. Is that correct?
I think he got 2 milligrams previous. Correct.
Okay. So I would give 4 milligrams of midazolam. And after that first dose of Ativan and that midazolam, if the patient's still seizing and I'm not happy with where this is going to go, I probably move to aggressive measures very quickly. So you could argue you could even give a higher dose of midazolam. You could give 5 or 6. And that, along with their lorazepam, would probably push you over to say benzos have been exhausted, which is where we want to get fairly quickly, because I don't want to leave this patient too long.
Gotcha. Now, we have two things going on. Of course, we have the patient seizing, but we also have this incredibly elevated blood pressure. At what point do you stop the benzos and start with some management of the blood pressure? Or do you first start with that lorazepam or whatever benzo, right? And then reassess the blood pressure after that? And what is your reliability that would improve simply with the benzos alone?
Yeah, if the blood pressure is being thrown off by either the mechanical action of the seizures or the fact that's in a huge sympathetic surge. Seizing is basically you're running a marathon. You're going to have enormous amounts of sympathetic surge affecting that blood pressure. So I'd be a little bit leery until the actual convulsion stopped to aggressively treat that blood pressure. So I would probably get the convulsion stopped, and I could do that very rapidly. The midazolam works near instantaneously. If that's going to work, I'll see the results. And if it doesn't, then I'm going to move to more aggressive measures, which involve taking the patient's airway and starting them on something like propofol. And that will stop their convulsions. Propofol also is a vasodilatory agent. It will treat the blood pressure. For me, I'd probably hold off right now for these first. We're going to get this patient one way or another under control from their convulsions, unless this is a really refractory case, within the first 10 minutes. So I think leaving the blood pressure where it is until I could actually see what it is without the convulsions would probably be how I'd play it.
So we frequently see patients that are seizing, right? And it's always that expression, doctor, don't just do something, stand there. So that is the next question for you as far as intubation of this patient seems to be in status. They got some benzo prior to arrival. They're still seizing. We give that 4 milligrams. If they continue to seize at this time, how long do you wait before you intubate that patient? Because there's going to be some risk to that in the sense that after they are paralyzed, we're not going to know if that seizure is continuing, assuming that at many places that are listening to this podcast do not have the ability to do continuous EEG monitoring.
Yeah, so many beautiful things in there. First off is I would be leery of providing long-acting paralytics even at a place that does have the ability to get EEG monitoring to the bedside, because it doesn't happen quickly. And in general, even at great centers, it's going to be an hour before you get that EEG. So I don't use something like rocuronium in these patients. I think such is acceptable. You'll lose that ability to know for 8 minutes or so. But, and this is not what I recommend to people. I recommend people perform RSI to maximize first pass success. But for in my hands, I would just intubate this patient with propofol alone, unless something about their airway said, I need the muscle relaxation. But in almost every case of video laryngoscopy, I don't. And so propofol alone would be fine on this patient. And then I'd instantaneously know whether I've stopped the convulsions or not. And in places without the ability to get EEG, I think it's even more important not to have this patient paralyzed for any length of time, longer than succinylcholine, if that's still your practice to intubate with muscle relaxants.
Got it. So I'm going to nail you down just a little bit on the propofol. Are you starting with 1 mg/kg, 2 per kilo? I know a lot of times with obviously procedural sedation, I see folks that gradually give it until they get sedated. But obviously in this type of situation, you want to give them a slug of something big right up front.
Yeah, at least 2, if not 2.5. You go big. This patient has the blood pressure to support it. And if you have a patient who doesn't, which would be weird because, again, amidst the convulsions, their blood pressure is sky high, then you could just support their blood pressure if that's really what you need. But again, I've never seen a hypotensive seizing patient that didn't have something else horrible going on, like the seizures were hypoxia from their gunshot to their chest or something. So yeah. And the trap, I don't think this case will go this way, but this is another potential failing, is I think even though you'd be supported by most current guidelines to try an anti-epileptic and wait, I think that is bad care. And the people who agree with me are some of the smartest people in the neurocritical care world on the management of status epilepticus. I think if you're giving something like a fosphenytoin or a levetiracetam and waiting 20 minutes to see those results while the patient's still actively convulsing, you're really not understanding the pathophysiology of status epilepticus. So for me, it's benzos, intubate, incredible general anesthetic medication. And then as I'm doing that, I'm adding in the anti-epileptic, but it's not stopping me from immediately terminating the convulsions by a potent action of something like high-dose midazolam, propofol.
So my last question before we find out what the actual provider did and then move to the next decision point is, and this might be a little foreshadowing what eventually happens with the patient, but do we have a risk, say, for example, we give that patient 2 mg/kg of propofol, right? Do we have a risk of decreasing that blood pressure too much? Because just to restate, the patient's blood pressure when they return is 224 over 140. I'm guessing your goal is probably similar to mine, say 15% or maybe even 20%. That's not that much. You're going from like 220, just for example, say down to 180, 190, right? Do we have a risk of overshooting things with the propofol, or are we pretty safe with propofol and benzodiazepines as opposed to some of those really potent medications that we can use and we'll see are used later for decreasing the blood pressure?
Yeah, it's a very hard question. Let's pretend we knew nothing about this patient. We had no baseline blood pressures. We didn't know their visit happened. Maybe they just rolled in and we didn't have time to look at the old medical chart. We're probably not going to be thinking along those lines. Now, maybe we should, but honestly, I think if we had reality there and we saw that blood pressure, we're going to probably account it to the patient's increased sympathetic tone. And we probably wouldn't think about that too much. Now, should we be? If they came in at 220 and we dropped them to 120, that's problematic to me. And I would probably, that would be enough to spark, oh, that's probably not a great idea. And then we could support that patient's blood pressure. But I don't know, Mike, it would be really hard. It's really hard for me to separate knowing the outcome of this case. I was involved with the Bounce Back's critical care book, so I know where this patient's going. I really want to give the listeners the truth of the matter of, would I be paying attention to that blood pressure dropping? Probably not. Probably not. And I think you're going to be fine with that in almost every case. This case, it might have looked bad later on. When you see that 220, you're like, that's not good. And you don't say, I'm going to give medications that may bring it down, but I don't want him to bring it down so much when it comes to something like propofol or midazolam. Now, when you use a specific agent to bring the blood pressure down, that's a different story. Your titration parameters, it makes sense. I don't want to go too low. Would I ever actually think about that in just the patient who came in status epilepticus with a blood pressure 220? I don't think I would, honestly. I don't think I would.
That's really good to know, because when you think of that 15%, exactly what you're saying is really important. We have patients who don't have hypertension who come in seizing. And my guess is if you check their blood pressures, they'd probably all be pretty significantly elevated, but that doesn't mean that's a chronic baseline level. Now, whether this clinician actually was able to access the previous chart before or even during someone accessed it, maybe during this whole resuscitation, it's hard to know that they actually had this elevated blood pressure. And we don't even know for sure with that previous blood pressure if that was their baseline, although I'm guessing that this patient did have pretty significant elevated blood pressure. So I'm going to tell you what happened. We're going to move to decision point B. And the physician actually handled things similarly, but not quite exactly the way that you had recommended. They gave, and remember, they got 2 milligrams of lorazepam in the squad. They got 2 more milligrams of lorazepam when they got to the ED. They ordered a whole bunch of labs. You can imagine those. Blood fingerstick blood sugar is 86. The seizures did not abate. They gave a third dose of lorazepam, and then they also gave 1 gram of Keppra. They ordered that, but at this point, the patient became hypoxic and they made the decision to intubate. They used etomidate and succinylcholine. So interestingly, they did use that more short-acting paralytic. And then they used a direct laryngoscopy. And I'm like a poster child for video, but they used the direct. They got it. Everything was fine. They put in a 8-0 endotracheal tube, uneventful intubation. However, they did continue with the resuscitations. Let me ask you first, the post-intubation analgesia and sedation that you would use for this patient.
Yeah, I would just, at this stage of the game, because midazolam drips take a while to come up, and the short-term propofol is just fine, and it's a great transition from intubation to the point of being on the eventual sedative agent that you want to keep them from seizing, I would just start this patient on high-dose propofol. And at the depth I'm going to put him for its anti-epileptic effect, I don't really need to worry about analgesia right now. I will eventually, as I lighten this patient up. But for right now, just to get the CT scan, I would probably just start a very high-dose propofol drip.
Perfect. And again, not that anyone needs to know this, but that's exactly what I almost always used after intubations, propofol. And it seems to work really fantastic, right? Of course, we're all going to image this patient. There's obviously many things intracranial that could be happening. Say, Scott, the blood pressure is the same. The medicines we've given and the propofol hasn't helped anything. There's still something like 220 over 140. Would you start treatment of that blood pressure prior to imaging? Or do you feel like that imaging is more important to have a result from? And because we can do it so quickly, you'd rather just get them over there, get the imaging done, and then bring them back and start the blood pressure medication at that time.
Yeah. So it's funny because there's a thing I speak about when analyzing resuscitation, which is resuscitation by story. And this is the idea that we could tell stories that make us look like our care is good. But then if you ever were just a fly on the wall observing it, even though the story is correct, the aggressiveness by which the story components occurred is very different than the one that is relayed as the story is told. Now, what do I mean by this? Okay, you could say we decided that imaging was more important, so we held off on blood pressure treatment until the return from imaging because the CT took precedence. Well, okay, story sounds fine because in that mind of the listener who's gathered around the fire listening to your story. Okay, so they went to CT scan with an immediacy that led to the CT being done in 3 minutes, and then they were back and then treated the blood pressure. But Mike, from reality, that if you looked at the times, that's just not true. Even something as simple as a head CT is a 20-minute trip. And it brings up the question of what the hell you were doing during those 20 minutes, because it's not an all or none. If you say, oh, the scanner's open, let's get this patient over there, I got no problem with that. And what should happen is a nurse should follow that patient with the nicardipine, and they should put it on a pump and start that nicardipine on the patient. And if the CT is not available and you want to start the nicardipine before so that we could titrate it as they're going over there, that's fine too. But this patient needs imaging and they need blood pressure control. And both of those can happen regardless of which one is initiated first. It's not acceptable to wait till they get back. This is most of the patients you just send to CT and let that happen. This is a patient that still is in the midst of aggressive resuscitation while they're getting their scan. They might start seizing again and need an increase in their medication. You need a doc and a nurse over there with this patient. And I'll go further and say, for me, a real tip that I try to give people is on a patient like this, who could be intracranial hemorrhage, who could be some form of ischemic stroke, it's not a 15 or 20% rule with me. I want them at 180. That's the magic number. It's the magic number if they need aggressive therapies for an ischemic stroke. It's the beginning of blood pressure management if they have an intracranial hemorrhage. And so I will bring a patient like this, regardless of what their initial BP is, to that 180, and then I could regroup after I know what the hell's going on and figure out where to go from there.
And one big thing I'm hearing you saying is that the inclination to slap high fives after the intubation and walk out and go see four or five other patients and come back in half an hour should absolutely be avoided. We have really only started the resuscitation and the care for probably what is the sickest patient, at least as far as the sickest patient that has a chance of recovering, right, in the entire ED here. So without a doubt, that next level of excellence, right, calling over to CT, hey, can you clear the table? This is when we're sending the patient over. That way there's no delays getting there and getting back, making sure that we not only have stuff we put in the computer, but also verbally talking to the nurse and talking to the team. This is what we're going to do with medication. These are what my goals are. If we're monitoring the blood pressure by an A-line, if people are able to do that in their shops, we're going to make sure we have that in, and we're going to make sure that that doesn't delay care either. And we're going to get to that in just half a second here. But before we do that, I'm going to tell you what happened here at this point, what the actual clinician did, and then we're going to move on to our next decision point. We actually have four decision points for this case. So
love it.
The patient got, they got 4 milligrams of lorazepam post-intubation, and can't really fault them for that. It'll help with sedation as well as if the patient is still seizing. And remember, they did give the succinylcholine. We got some labs, which are not that exciting. The potassium is a little bit elevated, 6.3. The patient had some element, what seems like probably acute renal failure, creat 4.8. The CK was 4,300. So patient actually then went over to CT from this situation. This is what this physician did. And when they got back, they had some irregular shaking motion that was documented. There was some debate between the treating physician and the resident as to whether that was actually seizure activity or agitation. They repeated the vital signs. And here we are, almost exactly the same. Blood pressure 228 over 142, heart rate 126. So they started the patient on the Keppra. They ordered the propofol, as you had talked about, and then they reviewed the brain CAT scan themselves, which did not show any evidence of intracranial pathology. So let me get now to decision point three. Before we get to actually some of these decisions, PRESS, posterior reversible encephalopathy syndrome, is that the same, Scott, as a hypertensive emergency, or is it something different?
It's not the same as a hypertensive emergency, but I think where you're going with this, Mike, if I'm going to read your mind, is it the same as a hypertensive encephalopathy?
And, yes.
And that is my contention. Now, there's no proof for this, that this is the exclusive cause of hypertensive encephalopathy.
Hey, folks, but you know we're not getting right to the show because you're listening to the free foam feed of MCRIT rather than the members-only feed. Now, I'll put you out of your suspense. This is a full episode. You're not going to be cut off. Don't get upset that, you know, you're hearing this. And now, 8 minutes from now, you're going to be listening, super excited by what you're learning. And then all of a sudden, and no more episode. You never want to hear that sound again. You're not going to hear it in this one. But you're going to hear it in a bunch of others because you're not a member. And membership is so cheap and so beneficial to the care that you could provide your critically ill patients in the ED or ICU that it's just crazy that you're still hearing this message. So go to mcrit.org/join, become a member, do it before the end of the year. You could write it off on your taxes. You could use your CME funds. And then all of a sudden you get all of the stuff that is not available in the free feed and you never have to hear this message again. Please consider joining and thank you, thank you, thank you for listening.
That always seemed like a vague one. It always pissed me off when dealing with hypertensive emergencies because all the rest of them had a clear pathology. So there was no hypertensive emergency. Hypertensive emergency was the secondary problem that was from a primary true issue. So for instance, if your blood pressure is sky high and you had an intracranial hemorrhage, then that's the intracranial hemorrhage is the problem. The hypertension is just there as a part of it. Same thing for SCAPE, sympathetic crashing acute pulmonary edema, aortic dissection, meth overdose. All of them had a primary problem. But hypertensive encephalopathy seemed to be its own thing, and it was a very vague thing. And the reason I think that happened was we weren't getting MRIs on most of these patients. And I think almost all of those hypertensive encephalopathies, certainly the lion's share, I would argue that I'd love to see the data that would prove what I think, which is it's the exclusive cause of true isolated hypertensive encephalopathy, is that you MRI'd all those patients, you'd find evidence of PRESS. So my guess is it takes up the majority of hypertensive encephalopathy is PRESS.
Okay, next one, a very quick question here. Does a negative brain CT rule out PRESS?
No, hell no. And that's why I think we weren't finding it, is these patients weren't getting MRI for their continued symptomatology. And if we had, I think we'd discover it a lot more.
if we ourselves as emergency physicians looked at that brain CT ourselves, we're looking for big stuff like bleed, obviously, and we don't see press, missing press on our own read, does that change the management at all?
It won't, so long as you're managing the blood pressure anyway. I think you're going to probably luck into being okay because there's not too much you could do in that early phase. If you did aggressively manage BP regardless, then yeah, it wouldn't matter so much. As long as you said, patient, obviously they're going to be getting, in this case, neuro involved anyway, who will certainly think of press because of the seizures. But if the patient didn't seize and you had a continued source of coma, then the ways to fail are not to manage the BP and not to involve neurology. And if you did either of those things, which I think every ED doc would do, then I think you're going to be okay even without making the diagnosis.
Got it. So you mentioned the elevated blood pressure. Of course, that's going to be our really most important thing right now. So what is the role of fluids? I know that if we order like 1 cc of IV fluid, the nurses are like, oh my God, this is going to increase their blood pressure. Because we also have this acute renal failure, right? So we're treating the whole patient. I mean, there's other things too. And maybe decreasing the blood pressure is going to help with that eventually. But would you give fluids? And if you would, how much would you give at this time?
I probably wouldn't unless something else pointed me towards that. Something on my ultrasound exam, or we didn't have a BUN with that creatinine. Maybe if it was pointing to pre-renal, it might shift me over a little. But this patient's going to be getting a ton of fluid just from their medications alone for all their status stuff. They're fine right now. 4.8 creatinine, that's not acute renal failure. That took a while to get there. I don't think this is a patient who fluids are really going to be the win unless they're hypoperfused. And in this patient, they're certainly not. I think fluids is something later on down the line for me.
Okay, so let's hit the most important thing here, the nicardipine. This is a very sensitive medication here. And again, it's not just the thing that you order and walk away and go for lunch. Give us some pearls on use of nicardipine, some of the benefits, obviously, and then also, as we'll see later, some of the potential risks.
Yeah, so being a pure arterial vasodilator that has very little effect on inotropy and cardiac output, this has become the darling of all of neurocritical care. And it's the only agent you need for hypertensive emergencies of any ilk, except for things like aortic dissection, where you need to control heart rate as well. But then even in that, nicardipine is going to be the backbone of that management. It's just going to be starting with something like Esmolol beforehand. So nicardipine is the emergency anti-hype for hypertensive emergencies. So it works out really nicely. But it's a medication that was built to fail because the way the manufacturers taught people to rapidly load it is incredibly dangerous. Most medications we give, you push some amount of that medication to get your initial effects. You are at the bedside pushing it, or the nurses are, seeing the results. And then when you get to where you want, then the natural pharmacodynamic intervention is to start an infusion, right? So there's a load and an infusion. Nicardipine has that same strategy, but the way it's done is very different than we're used to. You're not pushing a medication and then starting the infusion. What you're doing, if you want rapid control, is the rapid up titration of nicardipine is the load. And then when they are at or near where you want, you need to pull way back for the infusion. So both things are still happening, but unfortunately they're blended. What should happen on a patient like this is you would very rapidly work your way up from the initial starting 5 to, for me, I'd probably hit 10 very rapidly with a patient this blood pressure this high, and then maybe even hit 15 very rapidly, and then watch the blood pressure get knocked down until I'm about 10 away from my desired blood pressure, 180 in this patient. So they're at 190, and I would pull way back to 3 milligrams, and this is what the manufacturer is telling you to do. So I've gotten my load by rapidly getting them up to the 15, letting them sit there for 3, 4, 5 minutes, however long it takes, and then pulling way back to my infusion dose of 3, and then working my way slowly back up from there as the blood pressure may creep up to 184, 186. Okay, I want them back to that 180. So I go from 3 to 4 or something very small. And if you do that, it's a beautiful medication. That's not what people do, Mike. What they do is they're not controlled at 10. I'll go to 12.5. Oh, I need 15. Now they're a happy place. They're 178. I'm so pleased with myself. They pat their backs. They walk away. That patient is guaranteed to wind up in the toilet on their blood pressure.
Foreshadowing accomplished. So before we get there, I just want to ask you the final question, because on our problem list, obviously, patient has seizures, patient has significantly elevated blood pressure, patient is altered, obviously, patient also has the renal failure, acute or chronic, probably chronic, but they've also have this elevated potassium. So just very briefly, 6.3, would you do anything right now with the potassium, Scott, or address this underlying problem of the elevated blood pressure and then have that rechecked later.
Yeah, they have everything that would speak to the legitimacy of that number. When a patient who has no issues, who has an elevated potassium, you say, oh, maybe this is spurious, let's recheck. But this patient with a creatinine of 4.8, I believe it. But 6.3 doesn't blow my socks off, so I don't have to be ultra aggressive on this patient. If they have no crazy EKG changes, and I doubt they do, then you could just start your gradual lowering, and there's no reason not to put those orders in. But it's certainly not the primary issue this patient has. So I would treat, but I wouldn't make this my primary focus.
Got it. So decision point C, what did the provider do actually here? The provider gave 1 gram of calcium gluconate, they gave sodium bicarb, IV insulin and IV dextrose, consulted nephrology, and then they documented a patient with presumed hypertensive encephalopathy. This is the actual documentation. I've started antihypertensive therapy with nicardipine, so just like you said, and paged neurology as well as the ICU team for admission was started on nicardipine at 5, was steadily increased by the bedside nurse to 15. Repeat blood pressures were documented. I'm just going to give you these and then I'm going to let you go from there a little bit. So remember, the patient presented 1102, 224 over 140, and the blood pressure stayed in the 230 range until 2:05 a.m., at which point the blood pressure over a period of 19 minutes till 224 plummeted down to 136 over 74. 2 minutes later, it was rechecked as 119 over 68. Scott?
I'm reading back at this documentation. It seems like they started the nicardipine at about 149 in the morning. And this plummet was, we don't know, because the last high blood pressure they had was 205, which is about 15 minutes after that initial dose. And this bedside nurse, I guarantee you, was not titrating up as quickly as I do, because it's completely off label to go up as quickly as I do. You're supposed to wait 5 or 10 minutes between each up titration. So my guess is that what happened is this patient hit their 15 milligram mark at some point. BP was controlled. And then when they rechecked, which unfortunately was 20 minutes later, the patient had been getting 15 with lowering blood pressures all throughout that period. And when they finally did recheck at 136 over 74, that's way too high a drop for a patient who's had chronic hypertension for so long. Yeah, it's the exact problem that we were talking about earlier with nicardipine. That you have to stay at the bedside until you actually get your goal target. And they never did. They never had a documented 180, which is what you want. And as soon as you get that 180, you need to drop it way, way down from like 15 to 3.
So let's now move on, because we are at decision point D now. This is our last decision point. We do have this patient, and this happens sometimes, of course. So now, Scott, what do you specifically do with this decreased blood pressure? And again, it was 19 minutes until it was rechecked, at least with the documentation of it, 228 down to 136, then 119 a couple minutes later. We have that patient, and now they're too low. So what do you specifically do medication-wise at the bedside?
Yeah, this patient would go on a vasopressor drip at my place. So they'd go on norepi. If that's going to take any period of time, I would give push-dose vasopressors. I don't want to overshoot, so I'd be gentle with that. But you want to, beyond simply it's the right thing to do, it also denotes a recognition that a problem was actually there. And we aggressively treated it as soon as we discovered it. Because, and you could disagree, Mike, I think you'll probably agree, is the way you get nailed medical legally is not necessarily by doing something that might differ from what another expert would do, but by not recognizing something really critical has occurred or that the patient may have a problem. You know, if you write, notice blood pressure decreased quite significantly, we immediately treated to continuous cerebral perfusion with whatever you write next to that, you've shown, okay, it would have been great if the problem didn't occur, but you immediately responded to it versus you just let it drift back. Then doctor, you didn't recognize that every minute of that lack of cerebral perfusion was incredibly deleterious to that patient, did you? So for me, whichever action you take is probably okay, but taking an action, I think, is the most important thing.
And being open and honest about it. So something like a documentation nurse called and said, this was the blood pressure. I immediately was at bedside. We did this, that, whatever. And speaking of, and that is the thing that I think can most likely help you medically legally later, because it demonstrates that you cared about that patient. And in the end, caring about that patient and being proactive with it is going to be the thing that's going to save you more often than not. So specifically, you would give that medication, either something like norepinephrine or a push dose pressor, what do you do with that nicardipine drip? Do you just stop it completely?
Yeah.
Or do you decrease it while you're doing those other medicines?
No, you turn off the nicardipine drip because you want that BP to drift back up. And then you will reinitiate it at the point where they're at goal BP again. And there's no problem with that. So yes, turn it off immediately. Now, unfortunately, nicardipine has a dual metabolism because we think about it as a rapidly off agent. And about half of it could come off rapidly, which hopefully is enough in this patient. The other half sticks around for a while. So you still can have drug effect of it, which is why the pressor agents may also be necessary. But yeah, you got to turn that medication off instantaneously when you discover this.
So that's really important for folks to know that just because you turn it off doesn't mean your blood pressure is going to immediately rebound within 60 or 120 seconds, right? Which is why you're talking about the medication such as norepinephrine that you can use in conjunction with turning that off. So I'll tell you what happened here, Scott. The documentation reflected that the patient had suffered a profound drop in the blood pressure from the propofol and nicardipine is what they thought was going on. The patient's nurse noted the decline, immediately stopped all medications, informed the doctor, who gave 2 liters of IV fluids. They did not start the patient on any vasopressor medication. The blood pressure over a period of time increased. So as you remember, at 2:05, it was 2:28. At 2:26 a.m., it was 119. At 2:40, it had only gone from 119 to 145. And then at 3 o'clock in the morning, so 20 minutes later, was 169. And I'm going to tell you what happened to the patient. A MRI scan was done as an inpatient, demonstrated a hyperintensity and restricted diffusion of the bilateral frontoparietal region, consistent with a watershed infarction, as well as some subcortical vasogenic edema in the bilateral parieto-occipital region consistent with PRESS. They were unable to be weaned off the mechanical ventilation. They had a trach, they had a PEG tube, and they were admitted to a long-term acute care facility. Scott, this is a tough case. When the patient came back with their seizures, the physician did a really good job for almost all of the things that they should have done with the benzodiazepines, with the cerebral imaging, with the nicardipine drip. But I think it'd be really helpful to folks to get, and I know we talked about a lot of this already, but just some take-home points as far as any of us. They say the smartest doctors don't learn from their own mistakes, but the mistakes of others, right? What are some things we can really take home from this as far as improving our care at the bedside during our next shift?
Oh, gosh. Yeah, I think overall a pretty good job was done. I think at the end, responding more aggressively to that drop in blood pressure would show that they understood that every minute counts when you're talking about hyperperfused brain. I would have been more aggressive. Fluid is not the way to go to solve this patient's blood pressure issues. It takes too long and it's not necessarily going to work. So now at the end of 30 minutes, the patient's blood pressure may not have come up with the fluids and now you're 30 minutes down the hole. So that, I think, is one of the more problematic areas. That first visit, I know, as we mentioned, you're totally safe not sending labs. I think if they had, this patient's course may have been different because if I saw 4.8 creatinine, I'd probably have brought that patient back to the hospital. Now, it's very weird. It is that first visit where the patient was fine and now all of a sudden they just clicked over to that point where they actually had hypertensive injury to their brain. It's so strange that the day before, the patient was pristine, right? 24 hours before. I think they're almost burned by that more than anything. If this patient came in de novo with the same set of symptoms, it doesn't look as damning as them having that visit. And yet that visit shouldn't sway the needle. That patient looked fine. They obviously had renal failure, but without the labs, that wouldn't have been discovered. So what do you think, Mike? You're the medical legal expert in emergency medicine. What take-home messages from the medical legal side? I could speak to clinical all day long, Mike, but you're so much smarter on the medical legal side of this. So tell us everything we should have learned from this case.
Yeah. So for the first visit, I agree that the patient could go home. I don't routinely check labs on those patients, but I do routinely check a repeat blood pressure. And look, I'm good with 180, I'm good with 200. When you're getting to like the 240s over the 140s, that is a pretty elevated blood pressure that maybe it's still okay to send them home, but you'd want to have some increased vigilance as far as the reflection of what transpired at the bedside. And that vigilance is demonstrated in your documentation, right? By making sure the patient understands the importance, that there's some sort of plan for how that's going to be addressed. If they've had recent labs with a creat 3 weeks ago, that was fine. But if the patient is a brand new patient that just happened to get this and they're coming in, certainly a consideration either of checking those labs at the time, like you say, or a plan on how that's going to be done. And I'm just going to give a little bit of a caveat with another type of scenario. And we all get these CTs or ultrasounds back, cannot exclude cancer, right? Patient needs follow-up. They don't need to have further studies with an MRI done in the ED or obviously biopsies. I always put that in my discharge. And some people are like, I don't really want to worry the patient. I put in there, radiologist is concerned that, and they cannot exclude a malignancy or a cancer based on that imaging, and this is what you need to do for a follow-up. So having that very defined follow-up as reflected that the patient understands the importance of it is super important. And then the second part is when the patient came back, and again, I think this was maybe even we could argue about it, but if it was standard of care, but was it excellence in care? And I can tell you from working in a community shop now going on almost 30 years in about a year and a half here, it is so busy at times and you're running around and you blink your eyes and an hour goes by. This is the patient that you need to just force yourself to, if you're not going to be at the bedside, get back in there every 3 minutes, every 5 minutes, make sure you're checking the blood pressure, making sure everyone on the team understands the importance and the plan that you have arrived at. And that's reflected in your notes. This is also one that even if it's busy, I'm going to put some contemporaneous notes in my chart before I even know the outcome of that patient, because I realize this patient has such a huge crash potential, especially when you're using a medication like nicardipine, where maybe this is a new nurse, or maybe you're a physician who doesn't frequently use this medication and isn't that used to it. So making sure that you're there and that's reflected is so important.
I love all that. I'll make a quick clinical point and then I want to go back to some medical legal stuff. Clovidipine will eventually be a generic drug. And I think it's a lot easier to get that medication right without having to remember what I told you about the weird load or infusion changes. Or we could just, and I hope someone does the studies to prove that this is a valid strategy, start giving IV pushes of nicardipine so that it is, again, a standard. Load them up by pushing while you're at the bedside, get them to where you want, and then start an infusion. And then I think these errors wouldn't happen. Mike, would you represent this patient as a defense witness? This doctor, I'm sorry.
For the initial visit, I would, yes. I think that there's going to be some problems and there's really no perfect chart when it comes to that. And boy, I really wish that blood pressure had been rechecked, but say that it wasn't, or say it was rechecked and was still elevated and the patient was still asymptomatic. I would feel comfortable still defending that physician because, again, this might have been the last 10 years their blood pressure was exactly the same in this 55-year-old guy. So in the end, I would have represented them as a defense witness, but I think there were, again, not to be like a broken record, but there were a few things that could have taken us from standard of care to excellence in care with that initial visit.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think they met the standard of care. I think most ED docs would have done exactly what they did when that low blood pressure was seen. They would have just given the 2 liters of fluid. I don't think that's the right care, but I think if you're being judged by what most people would do as reasonable providers in that circumstance, I think they did actually achieve that.
One other really important point, I know we've touched on it briefly, but putting something in your chart like this meets ASEP guidelines, if there's a bad outcome, why don't we talk about that later, right? at your deposition, you can talk about what ASEP says and what you did. Because when you put that in there, what you've done is introduced a whole document to the plaintiff attorney that they can go through and show how your care deviated from what's in this 10, 15, 20 page document. And in the same way, there is really no point in saying something like, and it's not this case, but something like the patient was annoying or shouting expletives, because in the end, that's all part of the chart from someone else. And that can all be parsed out later. I just don't see the advantage of putting something in there like the ASEP guidelines. Now, I do think there's something important about, for example, the PERC rule. And I know I keep using that as an example. I use the PERC rule all the time. I think that's fine to put that in there. But again, I would put in there those specific elements. The more specific with the documentation, not in all your charts, but maybe in your three or four patients where there's some diagnostic uncertainty with the potential for an adverse outcome, those are the times that you really want your documentation to be excellent, to really describe what happened at the bedside. Again, not the alert and orient times three, but specifically talk about what you see when you walk in the room. The patient's on their phone, they're talking, they're animated, they're cracking jokes. That's hugely important when you then look at things later and someone's saying, no, the patient was altered or they couldn't walk when they left the ED. And you're like, oh, they weren't. I documented alert and orient times three. Put specifically in there what's happening. And then there's no room for any type of interpretation.
I love it. Perfect. Anything else we should add, Mike?
No, this is a common patient. We see these patients all the time. Asymptomatic elevated blood pressure is none of our favorites. You and I joked about that in the beginning here. But in the end, there is potential, maybe even not the next day happen with this patient, but there is the potential for adverse outcomes because treating blood pressure is one of our great successes in medicine. And making sure that the patient understands that is going to be our ability to really help patients going forward.
Perfect. I'm sure this won't be the last time we have you on, Mike, and I can't wait for the next one because you are a delight and keep doing the amazing work you're doing.
Thanks again, Scott.
So there you go. If you want to read the case, go to mcrit.org and look for the show notes for this episode. If you want to read more of these cases, buy Mike's book, Bounce Back's Critical Care. If you want to get out on time from your shifts and not have that misery of chart debt, then check out outontimecourse.com, outontimecourse.com. And of course, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention at the end of the show that I also do, in addition to these group courses, individual coaching. And one of the things we can talk about is shift efficiency and how to get out on time for individuals. And we could also talk about a whole lot more about making your life and career full of joy so that you are happy and not miserable, not burnt out, and not thinking, I need to leave emergency medicine or critical care, two of the best professions out there, but instead how to change mindset and activities and behaviors such that you actually love driving into work. And if you're interested in that, just come to mcrit.org/coaching. That's mcrit.org/coaching. Scott Weingart for the MCRIT podcast saying bye-bye. You hate that sound. I hate that sound. Why are you hearing that sound? You're hearing that sound because you are a unpaid listener to MCRIT, and yet this is one of those episodes where only the team members, the MCRIT members, get the full episode, which means you're missing out on tons of resuscitative goodness. You're missing out on the optimal way to care for your super sick patients. And it's sad because just going to mcrit.org/join would allow you to get full access, to get access to the RAC literature reviews, full episodes, extra goodies, bonus stuff for an incredibly inexpensive price. Your department will pay for it, or you could write it off on your taxes. You could get it done before the end of the year and become a full MCRIT member. Just go on over to mcrit.org/join, and you will now be someone exposed to all of the information to take care of your super sick patients that you want. You'll get this full episode and be able to actually perform a retrograde intubation. You'll be happy. So just go on over to mcrit.org/join and never hear this message again.